This is Audible.
Ashet Audio presents How I Play Golf, written by Tiger Woods with the editors of Golf Digest. Read by Walter Franks, with an introduction and afterword by Tiger Woods.
Hello, this is Tiger Woods. Success in golf is finding equilibrium, accepting the fact that this is a game of ups and downs, and learning something every time you tee it up. Finding that balance is a matter of trial and error. You must discover what works best for you and work diligently to maximize your potential. The difference between golf and most other sports is that anyone of average intelligence and coordination can learn to play it well. It requires a commitment to being the best that you can be. That has always been my approach to the game, for I too started as a blank page. Through my first teacher, my dad, the page began to fill. I absorbed as much information about the game as I possibly could. Through experimentation, I started weeding out what could and could not hurt me. More importantly, I began to understand what works best for me. Pop gave me many great lessons, not only about golf, but also about life. His greatest advice to me was to always be myself. I pass that along to you as the first lesson in this program, which I wrote as the ultimate tribute to Mom and Pop's ideal of caring and sharing. In essence, if you care for someone, you'll share with them your most treasured possessions. In this program, I will share with you a lifetime, albeit a relatively short one, of knowledge about the greatest game in the world. I believe it will assist you in attaining the deep joy and satisfaction that comes from playing the game well. I am convinced there is none like it. In many ways, it is a microcosm of life, teaching us both the depths and heights of character. It demands integrity, promotes camaraderie, encourages good health, and builds appreciation for the aesthetics. It is more than a well-struck iron or hole putt. No, it's not a game of perfection, but it is one of reality. And keeping it real is more than a worthy goal in any endeavor.
To give you a better idea of what to expect from this program, let me outline the four major areas of instruction that I'll cover. The first area will cover the short game, which will include putting and short course play. Second, I'll explore the full swing. In the third area of instruction, I'll discuss strategies for playing the game. And finally, I'll conclude with some thoughts on how to stay fit and motivated. I want to stress that these techniques are what's right for me in my golf game, and you may find that you have different strengths and weaknesses. But regardless, the methods I'll talk about are sound and far-reaching. And remember, you can always stop the tape and listen to sections over again. That way, you can make sure the lessons become part of your game. But first things first, golf is a never-ending journey. And before we begin, we should look at where we've been. Yearning to learn. I love golf as much for its frankness as for those rare occasions when it rewards a wink with a smile. It is pure, honest, and immune to sweet talk. Neither can it be bum-rushed. You must court it, slowly and patiently. Any other strategy will be met with a rebuff that for centuries has made grown men and women cry. Golf does, however, show you moments of vulnerability. They are the reasons we relish the courtship and the basis for our hope. It is that flicker of anticipation that draws us from the comfort of ambivalence to the certainty of rejection. Golf does not play favorites. I have been infatuated with the game since my pop first put a club in my hands when I was a toddler. I was an only child, and the club and the ball became my playmates. That feeling of solitude and self-reliance enhanced the game's attraction for me, and endures today. I suspect that is true of most people who have succumbed to the lure of the game. I recall from conversations with two of the greatest golfers of our time, Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus, that the game had a similar appeal for them. Golf affords you supreme independence. The cliche about the game being you against the golf course is only partly true. Ultimately, it is you against yourself. It always comes down to how well you know yourself, your ability, your limitations, and the confidence you have in your ability to execute under pressure that is mostly self-created. Ultimately, you must have the heart and the head to play a shot, and the courage to accept the consequences. Golf is a great mirror. often revealing things about you that even you didn't know. It cannot be misled. Sometimes the game comes so easily you can hardly believe it. Every swing seems natural and unforced. Every shot comes off exactly as you envisioned it. That false sense of security is part of the seduction. Every golfer has experienced it. If we are honest with ourselves, we'll admit never quite reaching nirvana, that feeling of invincibility. We are constantly on edge. There is no comfort zone in golf. Nor is it a game of perfection. If it were, we'd all shoot 18 and look for a more challenging sport. I shot a 61, my lowest competitive round, in the third round of the Pac-10 championships during my sophomore year at Stanford, and bogeyed the par 4 14th hole. I actually hit the ball better during the afternoon round and shot 4 strokes worse, including a bogey at 15. Only once do I recall feeling nearly in control of my game, and that was when I shot a 13 under par 59 at my home course in Orlando. Even then, I parred both par 5s on the back 9 with irons into the greens. The most we can ask of ourselves is to give it our best shot, knowing that sometimes we will fail. We are often defined by how we handle that failure. The great Ben Hogan, a man not prone to exaggeration, claimed that in his best week of golf he only had 4 perfect shots. I have yet to get to that higher plane. I won 12 times around the world in 2000, including 3 majors, and I only remember hitting one shot I would call perfect, a 3-wood on number 14 on the old course at St. Andrews in the third round of the British Open. From a tight lie, I had to hit a little draw into a left-to-right wind and carry the ball about 260 yards to a green guarded by a couple of nasty pot bunkers. As with every shot I attempt, I visualized the ball's flight and how it should respond upon landing. Because it was a blind shot, I picked out a crane in the distance as my target. The ball never left that line, and the shot turned out exactly as I had planned. Moments like that stay fresh in my mind, providing a positive image for future reference. Those images are critical when the game is on. They may even be the difference between success and failure. Sometimes the game seems so difficult you wonder whether the effort is worth it. It took me a while to understand why some days you have it and others you don't. Fact is, every day your body feels a little different, and golf is such a finite game that a little off can translate into a lot. 1 or 2 degrees here and there can mean from 4 to 7 yards. That's not a whole lot, but it's magnified due to the precision the game demands. We've all had one of those frustrating days. The final round of the 1996 NCAAs at the Honors Course at Ooltewah, Tennessee, was one I'll never forget. I struggled all week, even though I shot some great numbers. I just didn't feel comfortable with my swing. I didn't have the club in the right position, but I was getting away with it because my chipping was great, and I made every putt I looked at. I was somehow able to keep the ball in play for most of the holes and let my putter do the rest. In the final round, I lost it altogether. I went to the range that morning and never hit a shot. It just wasn't there. Sometimes when that happens, you can actually lower your expectations. Go out and shoot a great round. Not this time. I played the first 3 rounds with smoke and mirrors, and it finally caught up with me. Fortunately, I had a 9-shot lead, and the 80 didn't cost me an individual championship. I felt extremely fortunate. More like a survivor than a champion. Golf requires patience and perseverance. There are no shortcuts. Pop used to say, "You get out of it what you put into it." When my teacher, Butch Harmon, and I overhauled my swing during the 1998 season, Butch would sometimes have me repeat one movement for 30 minutes. I would get so tired it felt like my arms were going to fall off. But I kept at it until the move became ingrained in my muscle memory. Patience and practice will pay off. So will careful attention to the techniques explained in this program. Techniques I believe will work for everyone seeking to get the best out of their games. It is structured differently from other programs, beginning with the green and progressing to the tee. That's how my dad taught me, from the smallest swing to the biggest. The instruction combines visual, kinesthetic, cognitive, and performance ideals for practical application by players of all ages and abilities. Interspersed throughout the text are 7 secrets I have used to elevate my game, from becoming physically stronger to mentally tougher. I believe they will work for you too. Ultimately, golf is a journey full of learning and discovering. I hope, as you go through this program, you'll discover your game, one that is powerful yet precise, consistent yet exciting, impervious to pressure yet yielding large doses of fun. After all, that's the real reason we play the game. Sometimes we forget that. I did once. I was a junior golfer playing in the Orange Bowl Junior Tournament in Miami. I had the lead going into the final round and made a double on the front nine. I still had the lead, but for some reason I lost all joy and flat out quit. I took my second place trophy and pouted. Pop sternly reprimanded me. That's the only time I ever quit on golf in my life. From that time on, I realized what a privilege it is to play, and I never again lost sight of why I fell for the game in the first place. With that in mind, let's get started with some techniques to improve the short game. How to putt. I came to my first Masters tournament in 1995 thinking I could putt. Proud of my hat representing Stanford, where I was completing my freshman year, I was full of confidence. Like a lot of 20-year-olds, I had never seen a putt I didn't like. As a junior and college player, I could go deep when my putter got hot. I had 21 putts for 18 holes several times, and under pressure it seemed like I never missed. The length of the putt was irrelevant. I would just get up there and bang the ball hard into the hole. I was aggressive, confident, and had the touch to back it up. But I was in for a pretty rude awakening that Thursday at Augusta National. On the first hole on the first day, I stood over a 20-footer for birdie that I just knew I was going to make. It was raining and misty, the kind of conditions that tend to slow the greens down. A little voice told me to give the putt a little extra nudge. The practice green had been a touch slow by master standards, and I was determined to play aggressively. So I put a nice smooth stroke on the ball, accelerating the putter a bit faster through impact. The ball rolled nicely and slowed as it neared the hole, but it didn't stop. It trickled 3 feet past the hole, paused for a moment, then kept going, gathering speed as it went along. Next thing I knew, the ball had rolled completely off the green. Even then, it didn't stop. Suddenly, the gallery was parting to give the ball room to roam. By the time the ball stopped, I was farther from the hole than where I started and facing a very difficult recovery shot. It was a pretty startling moment. Even my playing partner, defending champion Jose Marie Olazabal, looked surprised. Though I was a bit shaken, I was determined to recover. I chipped the ball 15 feet, made that putt for a bogey, then somehow birdied the second hole. My advanced education on putting began on that first green at Augusta. It made me realize that, in order to play golf at world-class level, all areas of my putting had to improve. That lightning speed putt required more advanced preparation than I was capable of applying. It demanded a good read, a sound pre-putt routine, smart strategy, and local knowledge. It also demanded a superb putting stroke consisting of excellent mechanics, a fine touch, and solid contact. The ball had to be started on the right line, needed a perfect end-over-end roll with just the right amount of speed. That 20-footer really embodied what putting is all about. There are so many dimensions to putting that it really constitutes a game within a game. The more you examine putting, the bigger and more fascinating it becomes. To this day, I'm at least as captivated by putting as I am by the full swing. That's why I practice putting so much. I enjoy the process of altering my stroke a little when it gets out of kilter. I like the challenge of improving my touch, and the feeling I sometimes get when I know I can lag a fast, double-breaking 40-footer to within a foot of the hole, or else hole it. I'm fascinated by the art and science of reading greens. That's why you sometimes see me looking at a missed putt like I can't believe the ball made that funny little turn and didn't go in the hole. There is, and always will be, room for improvement. I guess that deep inside I'm still 20 years old and feel I can make every putt I look at. The goal, even if it isn't a realistic one, is putt my very best every day. A lot of players accept the idea that they will have good days and bad days on the greens and therefore don't work at it. In fact, study and practice produce results. Here's a tip to begin with. A great way to improve your feel is to putt with your eyes closed. After each putt, try to guess how far the ball rolled. This is the best drill for distance control that I know of. The All-American Grip. I see so many types of grips on the pro tours these days, it gives the impression there is no right way to hold the putter. Maybe there isn't. The main thing in putting, whether it's with your grip, posture, stance, or ball position, is to be comfortable. The putting stroke is not a very complicated action. My hands move only a foot at most in either direction during the stroke. My arms move less than that, your body less still and the head not at all. So the biggest priority in gripping the club is to establish a feeling of sensitivity, comfort, and relaxation. My putting grip is conventional in almost every way. If you look at the long history of the game and its greatest players, most of them have held the club very similar to the way I do. I'm glad I had them as models when I was young. So when I grip the putter, I go by the book. Take a minute to look at the photo insert on my grip under the heading, Putting Straight by the Book. See how I position both thumbs directly down the top of the handle. The thumbs are as sensitive as your fingers and provide the greatest amount of feedback as you swing the putter back and through the ball. A reverse overlap grip, with the left forefinger laid across the fingers of the right hand, provides a sense of unity. It doesn't lock the hands together in any way, but it does prevent either hand from becoming too dominant during the stroke. Additionally, my right thumb extends down the shaft to a point just below my right forefinger. Any farther and my right hand and wrist tighten a bit and don't hinge freely. Any shorter and I sacrifice control. The back of my left hand faces the target. This weak position discourages the hand from rotating excessively during the stroke. And finally, the back of my right hand is parallel to my left hand. You don't want your hands fighting each other during the stroke. By placing both hands square to the target, it's much easier to keep the face of the putter square during the stroke, at impact especially. If unique is what you seek, here's a small point. Most players like the handle running straight up the palm so the club shaft is parallel to the left forearm. But the handle of my putter runs under the butt of my left hand. My grip is unique this way, but I feel it gives me a little extra feel and gives me freedom in my wrist when I need it. When it comes to grip pressure, easy does it. I was on the practice green with Butch Harmon one day in 1998 when Butch noticed something. If you hold that putter any tighter, you're gonna twist the grip right off it, he said with a laugh. I always listened to Butch, and sure enough, I was holding the putter so firmly that I was squeezing the blood out of the tips of my fingertips at address. I tried to hold the putter more lightly, but I didn't seem to have the same amount of control. And even then, Butch said my grip pressure was much too intense. A few days later, Butch showed up with a device he attached to the grip of the putter. He fooled with the setting for a minute, then challenged me to hit some putts without making the device emit a loud beep. The thing went off the minute I addressed the ball. I lightened my grip pressure to quiet the thing, but when I actually went to hit a putt, it went off again. Man, that thing drove me crazy, but eventually I was able to hit putts without activating the beeper. Surprisingly, I putted pretty well with that new light grip pressure. Still, I wanted some reassurance that holding the club lightly was the way to go. Early in 1999, at the Byron Nelson Classic, I ran into Ben Crenshaw, who may be the greatest putter of all time. I asked him how tightly he held the putter. Ben said he gripped his putter so lightly it almost fell from his hands. The lighter you hold it, the better you'll be able to feel the weight of the putter head at the other end of the shaft, he said. Hearing that from Ben did it for me. I committed myself to easing my grip pressure, and it really paid off. I shot 63-64 over the weekend and won the tournament. But how light is light? I say that on the scale of 1 to 10, my grip pressure is about a 5. That may be tighter than Ben Crenshaw holds his putter, but it's pretty light for me, and I do have an increased sense of feel. If you're having trouble on lag putts, or if your speed isn't right on shorter breaking putts, check your grip pressure. No doubt about it, light is right. Perfect your posture. With putting, little things can make a big difference. One of the fundamentals sacred to me is posture. That applies not only to how I position my body mechanically, but also in the degree of relaxation I feel before I take the putter back. I believe in standing fairly tall at address. That enables me to see the overall line to the hole better than when I'm stooped over. What's more, it allows my arms to hang from my shoulder sockets in a loose, comfortable manner. That reduces tension right away. My arms also have more room to swing back and through during the stroke. Determining the right stance. Because there's so little movement in your legs and torso during the stroke, the width of your stance is more a matter of comfort than anything else. Some players feel a wider stance gives them a feeling of stability and stops them from swaying. Others feel a narrow stance helps them stand more erect and gives them a better view of the line. I varied my stance width over the years and have putted well with both a narrow stance and a wider one. So determining the best stance is really up to you. Focus on your eyes. The position of your eyes relative to the ball and the putting line is crucial. Ideally, I want my eyes directly over the ball at address. It indicates I am standing the proper distance from the ball. My posture is good, and I have a dependable view of the line I want the ball to roll on. If I err, it's better to position my eyes slightly inside the line. If my head is perched out beyond the ball, I'll pull a lot of putts to the left, or else have to manipulate the putter head during the stroke to make it track on line. It's also acceptable to set your head and eyes a little to the right of the ball, for a right-hander like me, at address. In fact, it's hard not to do that if the ball is positioned ahead of center a little, which is where most players like it. My eyes are a couple of inches to the right of the ball when I look down. It gives me a view of the hole that is similar to sighting a rifle. What I don't want to do is position my head and eyes farther up the target line than the ball itself. And finally, I always make sure my eye line is parallel to the target line. If I cock my head to the left or right at address even slightly, I'll subconsciously steer the putter head in the direction my eyes are aligned. I like to use the bill of my cap as a reference point. If the bill of my cap is parallel to the target line, I know my eyes are parallel also. That is, provided I put my cap on straight. Same routine without fail. A good putting stroke requires smooth rhythm and a steady repeating pace. One of the secrets to accomplishing that is to do everything else smoothly and repetitively too. I'm talking about my pre-putt routine, or the series of things I do before I actually pull the trigger with the putter. Regardless of your routine, the key is to perform it exactly the same way on every single putt. The thing about my routine is, I never change it. I do it at the same speed and go through the same thought process every single time. Not only do I gather all the information I need about the putt itself, I also get myself in the best frame of mind to stroke the putt. By the time I take the putter back, I'm in a great flow, physically and mentally. That's what a good routine can do for you. My pre-putt routine gets underway with a careful examination of topographical features on and around the green. If there's a pond nearby, I know the ball will tend to break toward it. If I'm playing a mountain course, I know the ball will tend to break away from the tallest peak in the vicinity. Only after taking these general factors into account do I begin studying the line of the putt. Style-wise, when I putt, my routine is typical. I replace my ball and pocket my coin. Take a general view of the putt standing next to the ball. Walk to the hole, taking a side view of the line to help determine slope. Examine the area around the hole. Walk back to my ball and crouch behind it. Getting the most telling view of speed and break, stand alongside my ball and make two practice strokes. Move the putter behind the ball and then shift my feet forward. Take a couple of more looks at the line and hole, and finally, I stroke the putt. To save time, I do much of my pre-putt routine unobtrusively while others are putting. But it's the same routine, every time. If you're listening to this tape on the putting green, feel free to stop and go back to review any of the routines or techniques I talk about. Practice is ultimately what will perfect your game. Same pace, back and through. From the time I was a little kid, and I mean about 4 years old, my dad hammered home the idea of swinging the putter back and through at the same speed. When you see a putting stroke that looks smooth, it's because the putter is taken back at a slow, even pace and then swung forward at the same speed. If you can stroke the ball from start to finish deliberately and with a sense of rhythm, it is much easier to keep the club head moving along the proper path and maintain a club face that is square to the path from start to finish. What I want to avoid is any sudden change in club head speed, especially on the forward stroke. Let your dominant hand run the show. Although both hands are charged with swinging the putter back and through at an even pace, your dominant hand has a special responsibility. If you're right-handed, you obviously have better feel in that hand than you do in your left. Therefore, you want to instill a sense of pace with that hand especially. I like to hit putts with my right hand only, making sure I incorporate the same amount of pace as when I'm putting with both hands. I allow my right wrist to hinge just a bit on the backstroke and then release a little through impact. But I never allow my right wrist to unhinge any farther than where I had it at address. Remember, your hand leads, the club head trails behind. Here's another quick tip. The style of putter you use is irrelevant. The important thing is to choose a putter that hefts well in your hands and gives you a feeling of confidence just looking at it. The importance of swing path. Once I align the face of the putter square to the target line, the most important thing is to return the club face to that position at impact. The best way to do that is to swing the putter straight back and straight through along the same path. Speaking from personal experience, that's easier said than done. On the practice green one day, Butch told me I was swinging the putter back on an inside path. I had been putting poorly, and this was the reason. Butch explained that when the putter goes back on the inside, you are forced to release the putter head aggressively through impact in order to get it back to square. That causes a lot of pulls to the left and pushes to the right, not to mention inconsistent speed control. Butch cured me fast with a little drill. Standing to my left down the target line, he reached forward with his own putter and placed the club head to the inside of the line. "Now hit the putt," he said. I did, and my putter head collided with his on the backswing. I tried it again. Same thing. It took some effort, but I finally got the putter moving straight away from the ball. I started putting better almost instantly. The straight back and through path is especially important on putts of 5 feet or less, where you aren't hitting the ball very hard. On longer putts, where I'm forced to turn my shoulders more in order to take the putter back farther, the putter head tends to move to the inside a little. That's fine. I'd have to separate my arms from my body too much to keep the putter moving along the straight back path. 6 keys to pure putting. The first key of pure putting is to maintain pace and rhythm in order to make your backstroke and forward stroke the same length. Remember, same length, back and through. If I take the putter back only a few inches on a 20-footer, I'll have to accelerate suddenly to get the ball to the hole, and I'd have to lengthen my follow-through as a result. The second key is to let your shoulders and arms do most of the work. The main source of movement during a putt is in the shoulders and arms. They act together. I don't want my arms running away from my shoulders at any time, during the backstroke especially. I want to keep my hands quiet during the entire stroke. The third key is to let your wrists hinge a little. Nothing is worse than a putting stroke that is all hands. There is too much play in the putter head that way, and a handsy stroke doesn't hold up well under pressure. I like to keep my hands and wrists subdued during the stroke. On the other hand, I don't want to freeze my hands and wrists entirely. If my grip pressure is light, as it should be, there is bound to be a tiny amount of hinging in my wrist. That's especially true on lag putts, where I need a longer stroke and more club head speed to get the ball to the hole. But keep in mind, you only want to use your hands as much as absolutely necessary. The fourth key is to allow your arms and the putter to act as one. I want the club shaft in my left forearm to form a straight, continuous line. To do that, I simply arch my wrists downward a little at address. By eliminating an angle between my forearms and the club shaft, the putter will do exactly what my arms do during the stroke. The idea is to eliminate unwanted angles and levers, so the stroke is more of a one-piece action. The fifth key to pure putting is to keep your head steady. Every good putter keeps the head absolutely still from start to finish. Every bad putter I know moves his head to some degree. It's as simple as that. If I move my head even a fraction, it's almost impossible to keep my putting path stable and true. It's hard to hit the ball solidly, too. More than likely, I'll open my shoulders on the forward stroke, causing me to pull the putter across the ball from out to in. I practice keeping my head dead still until well after the ball is gone. And the final key to pure putting is no peeking. If you're like me, you can't wait to see if the ball is tracking toward the hole right after the ball leaves the putter face. But the urge to glance up too soon has some nasty consequences. The tendency to peek too soon causes my head to move and leads to sloppy contact. Not only that, if I'm distracted by thoughts of where the ball is going, I won't focus on my main job, which is to keep the putter moving directly down the target line. I found an effective way to fight the problem. I practice putting with my left eye closed, so I can't see the target line at all with my peripheral vision. That makes it easier to keep my eyes looking straight down. Here are some additional thoughts about the putting game. Putting is largely about touch. To really get a feel for speed, the stroke should be easy, smooth, and natural. If you putt like a robot, stiff, locked up, and too mechanical, you won't judge distance very well, especially on longer putts. If you keep your left arm fairly close to your side on the forward stroke, the putter head will tend to rotate to the left after impact, the toe of the club passing the heel. Don't fight that tendency. The important thing is for the putter face to be square to the target line at impact, and that will happen as long as your release is smooth and unhurried. Some players are so desperate to avoid pushes and pulls that they shove the putter head down the target line, keeping the club face dead square from start to finish. It's a very unnatural action. It doesn't do much to provide square contact, and it's almost impossible to impart the right speed consistently. Handling breaking putts. The key to handling a left-to-right putt is to allow the putter to release or rotate freely through impact. That's harder than it sounds. The tendency is to let the putter head drift to the right toward the hole through impact. The result is a miss on the low side. Keep your head down, trust your line, and let the putter release naturally. And what about a right-to-left putt? Most right-handed players prefer a putt that breaks from right to left. That's because the arms and hands are moving outward, away from the body, through impact. It's a bit more natural to stroke the ball this way, rather than drawing your hands and arms inward toward your body through impact. Lagging the long ones close. The only time I welcome a long putt is when I've reached a long par 5 in 2 strokes. Nevertheless, I face putts of 40 feet or longer a lot more often than that, once per round on average at least. The goal, of course, is to avoid 3-putting. 3 putts are killers, and that doesn't say anything about 4-putting, which I've done a few times since I was a kid, but I'm glad to say I've never 5-putted. My goal is to lag my first putt dead to the hole, so I have nothing more than a tap-in left. That's setting the bar pretty high, but it's rare that I face a long putt so difficult that I can't lag it up there close. There are exceptions, of course. On the 17th hole at Augusta National during the Masters, they usually cut the hole on the left side of the green on Sunday. That part of the green slopes severely from left to right. If you stop your approach shot on the left side of the green, forget it. You can't hit your first putt within 8 feet unless you hole it. With that in mind, let me review 10 things to consider when making a long putt. Feel free to stop the tape after each point and practice. First, make your backswing and forward swing the same distance. That's the best way to assure a smooth, rhythmic stroke with plenty of feel. If your follow-through is a bit longer than your backswing, fine. But if it's shorter, you've more than likely decelerated the putter through impact. A sure killer. Second, swing the putter at the same pace, back and through. It's important that the putter be gaining speed as it strikes the ball. But if I can feel that my putter head is traveling at the same speed from start to finish, I'll accelerate through impact without thinking about it. Third, remember to let your wrists hinge. The harder I hit the ball, the greater the need to bring my hands into play. Just remember to hinge your wrists only as much as necessary to get the ball to the hole. Fourth, hit the putt solidly at all costs. If I miss the sweet spot of the putter face by 1/2 inch, which is easy to do when I'm making an extra long stroke, I can lose 10 feet of roll or more. Fifth, understand that a long putt is rarely perfectly flat. Ask yourself, am I putting uphill or downhill? As you approach the green, look closely to determine which side is higher. Sixth, ask yourself, am I putting into the grain or down grain? If I'm putting down the grain, I can often factor in a few extra feet of roll. Seventh, study the last 6 feet of the putt closely. Knowing the way the ball behaves when it's dying at the hole is crucial. Eighth, don't forget break. I can judge the speed perfectly, but if I push or pull the putt 5 feet, I haven't done myself any favors. Ninth, when putting up or down a tier, divide your putt into two sections. It's important that the ball arrive at the beginning of a downhill tier with just the right speed, and conversely, that it arrive at the top of an uphill tier with enough speed to get the ball to the hole. And finally, make practice strokes while looking at the hole. Concentrate. I make a point to see in my mind's eye the length of stroke necessary to impart the right amount of speed. Reading greens. What you see is what you get. The most memorable putt of my career remains the 30-footer I buried at Pumpkin Ridge on my way to winning my third straight U.S. Amateur Championship in 1995. In the 36-hole final against Steve Scott, I stood one down with two holes to play. My approach shot to the 17th hole was just so-so and left me a birdie putt of about 30 feet. I read the putt carefully and was certain it would break 5 inches to the right. Rarely have I felt so self-assured that a putt would behave exactly as I saw it. The moment I struck the putt, I knew I had started it online. And when it dove into the hole, I was excited, but not really surprised. I'm not sure there's a strong moral to that story, except that it pays to learn how to read greens. Reading greens is a science, and that you must take into account physical factors, such as the slope of the green and the type of grass you're putting on. But it's an art, too. Having competed on courses all over the world, I've experienced tremendous variations in terrain, weather, agronomy, and course conditioning. They all influence how the ball rolls. Here are some rules of thumb. Fast early, slow late. Grass grows quickly, enough that the same putt you hit at 8 a.m. can be considerably slower at 5 p.m. As with all rules, however, there are exceptions. When I won the 2000 U.S. Open at Pebble Beach, the greens got quicker as the day wore on. In the morning, the greens were damp and therefore slow. But when the wind came up, as it usually does, the greens dried out and got a lot faster. Learn to read the grain. Grass doesn't grow straight up. It tends to grow toward one side or the other. Grain isn't as big a factor as it used to be because greens are cut so short nowadays. Still, it's a factor, especially on Bermuda grass. Study the hole. One side will be shaggier than the other. A ball moving in the direction of the shaggy side will travel faster than one rolling against it. Another general rule, grass grows toward the setting sun. Wind can matter. When it's blowing more than 15 miles per hour, pay attention. A golf ball weighs only a little more than an ounce and a half, so you can bet it can be influenced by the wind, especially on very fast greens. Balls roll where the water drains. If there's a pond near the green, you can bet the ball will favor moving in that direction. Mountains are mystifying. If you're playing a mountain course, strange things can happen. Putts that appear straight will break for no apparent reason. The rule? Find the highest mountain peak in the vicinity. The green will tend to slope away from it. Narrow your world. A few years ago, I started cupping my hands around my eyes while I read putts. The reason I do it is not because I see more, it's because I see less. The PGA Tour can get some pretty big galleries, and there's always a lot of movement I sometimes find distracting. By forming a little tunnel with my hands, I can focus totally on reading my line. You probably don't have too big a crowd watching you play, but still there are distractions. Carts zooming around, fellows walking around the greens and so forth. If you have trouble concentrating, try my tunnel vision technique. It will sharpen your focus and help you hole more putts. How to get it down, turning 3 into 2. I don't think I've ever felt more pressure than the day our Western High School golf team was going up against our biggest crosstown rival to decide our district championship. We were playing the Los Coyotes Country Club in Buena Park, a nice course that has hosted the LPGA Tour. In high school, our matches were only 9 holes and were played at stroke play, with everybody's score counting. I was playing well and came to the last hole, 4 under par. But the match was very close. When I saw my coach and teammates gathered around the par 3 ninth green, I knew what I did on that hole could very possibly spell the difference between our team winning or losing. My tee shot sailed over the green, leaving me a tricky little downhill pitch from light rough. My ball was sitting up nicely. I figured I would have no trouble hitting a little flop shot up close to the hole, from where I would make the putt for par and lead my team to glory. I addressed the ball with my sand wedge, opening my stance and the club face. Taking a deep breath, I made a healthy-sized backswing, cut across the ball firmly, and whiffed the shot. My lie, as it turned out, had been too good. The club head had slid right under the ball. Now I faced an even more difficult shot, because the ball had settled lower into the rough. Feeling more angry than scared, I settled over the ball again and played the same type of shot, a high-risk flop. This time I holed it out. I saved a par, and our team pulled out the title. Two lessons were driven home to me that afternoon, lessons my dad had pounded into my head for years. The first is, a good short game can save a round regardless of how poorly you're hitting the ball from tee to green. The second lesson had to do with that whiff, that terrible shot, where I failed to judge the quality of the lie correctly, made it clear that I could never reach my full potential unless I built a reliable short game. As you'll see, there's more to getting up and down than you think. The stats tell the story. The thing I'll remember about my 2000 season was that I performed well in all facets of my game. Not having any really weak areas was the reason I won 8 tournaments, was the leading money winner, took home 3 major championships, won the Vardin Trophy for low stroke average, and was named Player of the Year. But it was my short game that made the biggest contribution. I ranked first in the greens and regulation category, hitting better than 3 greens out of every 4 with my approaches. That adds up to just under 14 greens per round, my best percentage ever. I also ranked first in putting. That's a telling stat, because if you're hitting lots of greens and making lots of putts, you're making lots of birdies. The scrambling category, where I ranked 3rd overall, was the real key and proves how important the short game is to scoring. When I missed the green, I got up and down for par or better 67.1% of the time. So of the 4 greens per round I missed hitting in regulation, I made par or better on 2 of them from all kinds of tough situations around the greens. If I had stumbled in that category, it would have cost me a few tournaments, the Vardin Trophy, and a whole bunch of money. The basic chip, nothing fancy. Once you establish a good chipping technique, the battle is 90% over. Whether you're chipping uphill or downhill, whether the shot is long or short, or whether the lie is perfect or a little scruffy, to be a good chipper, you need sound fundamentals. Some shots around the green are trickier than others, but they all revolve around the same simple approach. Take a moment to look at the photo insert of my setup under the heading, The Basic Chip. You'll see that I set my hands slightly ahead of the ball. Then I grip the club as I do the putter. I don't need a lot of hand action. Next, I position the ball slightly back of the center. That promotes a downward blow into the back of the ball. After that, I narrow my stance and lean a little toward the target. That promotes a downward blow, too. I flex my knees a little because I want my legs to feel alive. Finally, I choke down on the club for extra control. But first, see the shot happen before you hit it. The chip, like a putt, requires an advanced read, but I'm looking for more than how the ball will behave after it lands on the green. To control distance accurately, that's much harder to do than start the ball online, I choose a spot where I want the ball to land, and then form a mental picture of the ball actually traveling there. When I'm ready to go, I hold the club softly and make sure there's no tension in my arms. I open my stance to the target line. I see the line better, and it helps limit action to my arms and shoulders. I keep my chin held high, my back straight. A lot of bad chippers hunch down over the ball. And finally, I hold the club very lightly at address. Give it the old 1-2. The chipping stroke is simple. It's an easy 1-2 action controlled by the shoulders more than the arms and hands. You don't need much force. My goal is to hit the ball solidly, making sure the club head is traveling downward at the moment it strikes the ball. I start the backswing with my shoulders, allowing my arms and hands to follow. I don't let my arms separate too far from my body. Tempo is important. There's no need to rush on either the backswing or the forward swing. At all cost, I hit down the back of the ball. I don't try to help the ball into the air. The loft of the club will take care of that for me. The stroke may be short, but it's not a stab. I try to accelerate smoothly. A good thought is to return the arms to the position they were at address. That means my hands are ahead of the ball, no scooping. I keep my eyes focused on the back of the ball. After impact, my eyes stay focused on that same point. To get a better idea of what I'm talking about, take a look at the photo insert under the heading, Give It the 012. The number one mistake, flipping your wrists. This is worth a section of its own, because it deals with the single worst chipping error you can make, and unfortunately, the most common. That mistake is trying to help the ball into the air by uncocking your wrists too early on the downswing. I'm not sure what causes it, anxiety maybe? Or perhaps the feeling that you have to somehow help the ball get into the air. In any case, what happens is that the player flips the clubhead into the ball, leaving his arms and shoulders behind. All kinds of bad things can happen, from chili dipping and sculling to decelerating and hitting the ball too high or low. Depending on the length of the shot, it's okay to allow your wrist to cock a little on the way back. But on the downswing, your hands must lead the way, delaying the release of the clubhead until the last possible moment. If you relax and initiate the forward movement with your shoulders, you'll allow your wrist to uncock naturally, with no conscious effort on your part. Choose your weapon wisely. The best short game artists vary their club selection around the greens. They vary the speed, trajectory, and distance of ball flight with the club, not with the type of stroke they make. If it's a long chip that requires more roll than flight, you should choose a less lofted club, such as a 7-iron. Shorter chips can require anything up to a 60-degree sand wedge. Still, you probably are going to lean toward your favorite chipping club. My personal choice is my 56-degree sand wedge. At the 1998 Million Dollar Challenge in South Africa, I found myself locked in an intense duel against Nick Priest. We both had gone low that day and had separated ourselves from the field. At one point on the back nine, Nick birdied five straight holes, and I birdied four of the same five, and then birdied the next. We came to the last hole with me trailing by one stroke. Nick hit the green on the last hole and I didn't. Although I was closer to the hole than he was, Nick too putted for his par, and now it was my turn. Hold the chip and enter a playoff, or miss and take the long plane ride home. My ball was in the fringe 30 feet from the hole, sitting perfectly with a beautiful run to the hole. I really could have used any club for that shot. An 8-iron came to mind, then a pitching wedge, then my trusty sand wedge. All things being equal, I preferred my sand wedge. I just liked the look and feel of it. I chose a spot on the green to land the ball, went through my routine, got set, and hit the ball perfectly. It landed on the spot I had chosen, hopped once, started rolling and took the little right-to-left break perfectly. It dove into the middle of the hole and we played off for the title, which incidentally was worth more than $1 million. Nick, unfazed by my chip, won that playoff. But my point is, don't be afraid to have a small bias toward your favorite chipping club. As long as your favorite club can deliver the correct type of shot, you're allowed to deviate from the norm. How to handle greenside rough. Tall grass around the greens intimidates most golfers, and understandably so. For me, it's one of the hardest shots there is, though I've gotten much better at it. At the 2000 U.S. Open at Pebble Beach, I landed in the tall stuff a few times, but managed to save par almost every time. Generally, I use my 60-degree wedge. The tall grass tends to close the club face, and I need all the loft I can get. Then I distribute 60% of my weight on my forward foot, the one closest to the green. That encourages a steep, knife-like angle of attack with the club head. I hold the club more firmly than normal, especially with my left hand. Again, the rough will try to twist the club face closed. I make a very upright backswing, cocking my wrists abruptly. On the downswing, the force of the club head should be expended downward to penetrate the grass. I don't let the club head approach the ball on a level angle. I'd be at the mercy of the rough. Finally, I restrict my follow-through. In fact, if I hit down sharply, there won't be any follow-through. The three-wood chip. Butch Harmon taught me this shot early in the week of the 1996 U.S. Open at Oakland Hills, and I can't think of any other shot that had a bigger immediate impact on my game. The first time I tried it, on the 18th hole of the third round, I actually holed the shot. At Quad Cities later that year, I holed out using the three-wood chip three times. It's a much easier shot to play than you would think. But when should you play the shot? The three-wood chip is a good choice when your ball is in the fringe or in short light rough around the green. It's effective because the broad sole of the three-wood will resist getting snagged by the rough near impact. What's more, the three-wood has enough loft to carry the ball a few feet onto the green, from where it rolls like a putt the rest of the way to the hole. Don't try this shot if you're more than 4 feet off the green, or if your ball is sitting down in deep rough. Size up the situation carefully before you grab that lofted wood from your bag. Now, to pop the club face into the ball, I keep my left hand relaxed. I take the club head away from the ball low, so it brushes the tops of the grass. I use my wrist to pop the club face into the back of the ball, keeping the back of my left hand moving down the target line. I don't feel like I'm jabbing at the ball with the club head. I just accelerate the club head more quickly than usual. The worst thing you can do is let the club head slow down just before impact. And just a few reminders. Use your putting grip. I don't need a lot of hand action, so I hold the club as I would my putter, my left hand in a weak position and both thumbs down the top of the shaft, and grip down to the steel. Next to the driver, the 3-wood is the longest club in the bag. To play the chip as I would with a wedge, I need to choke down considerably, all the way to the metal below the grip. That effectively makes the club lighter and more maneuverable. I also can stand closer to the ball. The simple pitch. The pitch is not a long shot, but it requires a lot more hand, arm, and body action than the chip shot. That's because you need more club head speed to get the ball in the air. It really is like the mini version of the full swing. Even your lower body plays a role, as the hips move slightly back and through to accommodate the motion in your shoulders, arms, and hands. It's delicate balance. You need enough momentum to slide the club head through the grass and under the ball, but not so much as to rocket the ball over the green. The secret to hitting the ball high and soft is not to force it. 4 pre-swing adjustments will help you a lot. 1. Choose a lofted club, either your standard sand wedge or 60-degree wedge. 2. Open your stance by aligning your feet well left to the target line. 3. Open the club face as well to increase loft. And 4. Play the ball forward off your left toe. And here are some additional things to remember. Focus on your hands. The hands are much more active on the pitch than on the chip. I strengthen my left-hand grip a bit by turning it to my left at address. That will enable my hands to cock more easily during the swing. It's crucial that I hold the club lightly, both for mobility and feel. Also, let the club do the work, and the rest is easy. I pick the club up steeply on the backswing, allowing my wrist to cock naturally. Watch my tempo. I'm not making a long swing, but it still needs to be smooth and rhythmic. Finally, keep everything moving. My main downswing thought is to slide the club head under the ball. I make sure I accelerate. If I allow the club head to stop, I'll probably chunk the shot. I don't rotate my hands and the club head dramatically through impact. On the follow-through, the club face should be aiming at the sky. Proof I've maintained the loft of the club face. The 30-yard punch. One of the hardest shots to master, and one every golfer faces virtually every round, is the short punch from about 30 yards from the green. Like any shot that requires something less than a full swing, you need good technique and a soft touch to pull it off. I position my ball just back of center, which helps me hit down on the ball. I narrow my stance so my feet are between the width of my shoulders. I don't need a wide, stable base because I won't be making a very long swing. I start the swing low and wide, making sure my left arm is fully extended. I always remember to turn my shoulders and hips a little too. I never try to swing through the ball with my arms and hands alone, because it's too difficult to control the loft of the club face and regulate club head speed. My thought is to simply unturn my hips and let them guide my shoulders, arms, and hands through the downswing. A low abbreviated finish is my goal. It proves the big muscles have directed the motion, not my arms and hands. With this basic technique, I can play any variety of short shots. By moving my ball position forward a touch and choosing one of my sand wedges, I can loft the ball high. By playing the ball even farther back and choosing a less lofted club, I can play the bump and run. The flop, making the hard look easy. No doubt about it, the flop shot is a high-risk gamble. I only play it when I have very little green to work with or when it's the only way to get the ball close to the hole. Still, it's a shot every golfer needs to have. The nature of modern design features around many greens demands it. One of the keys to a good flop shot is you need a good lie. Never try the flop from hard pan or other tight lie. If you hit behind the ball even a fraction, the club head will bounce into the ball and scull it over the green. And never try it when the ball is sitting down deeply in tall grass. The average player doesn't have the strength to plow through the grass with sufficient force. A clean lie or even a fluffy one is fine, because you can slide the club head under the ball without much interference. When attempting a flop shot, technique is everything. My stance and club face are both open at address, with the ball played off my left heel. I grip the club more lightly than normal to promote lots of hand speed on the downswing. I like a wide stance because it forces me to execute the shot from the waist up. The swing is 90% shoulders, arms, and hands. On the backswing, I pick the club up steeply and cup my left wrist into a slightly concave V. That opens the club face even further, which guarantees maximum loft through impact. I make a long swing again to help generate speed. I accelerate quickly through impact, trying to slide the club under the ball. I remember to follow through. I don't want to chop at the ball. Lastly, I aim for the toe of the club. One of my tricks for making the ball land softly is to contact the ball on the toe of my 60-degree sand wedge. I still get the same high trajectory, but striking the ball out on the toe tends to deaden the shot. I can make a fairly aggressive swing without fear of catching a flyer that sails over the green. I can always count on the ball stopping very close to where it lands. How to escape from the sand. There are tough shots, and then there's one that I had on the 16th hole at Paupu Bay Resort in Hawaii during the 1997 Grand Slam of Golf. With three holes to play, I was trailing Ernie Els by three shots and desperately needed a birdie to have even an outside chance of catching him. When I saw my approach to 16 drop into the right greenside bunker, I knew a birdie would be unlikely, but not impossible. I'd holed sand shots before. But when I got close enough to observe my lie, I saw a shot that was close to impossible. The club had buried into the thick, wet sand. Worse, it was on a severe downslope. To get the ball out of the bunker would be very difficult, and if I did, there was no way it was going to hold the green. A thick clump of bushes beyond the green was beckoning to my ball. I was a dead man. Or was I? A steep, grassy embankment was just beyond the bunker. If I could somehow make the ball fly directly into the embankment, the ball might release forward and get on the green. It was 100-1 shot, but I had to try it. I addressed the ball as though I were ready to chop wood. I didn't swing the club back so much as lift it straight in the air, then brought it down into the sand as though I were swinging an axe. I swung as hard as I could, closing my eyes tight and hoped for the best. When I found the courage to peek at the outcome, I saw an amazing sight. The ball had shot straight for it like a bullet and slammed into the embankment. The ball jumped into the air a good 3 feet and continued forward, stopping 2 feet from the hole. I knocked the putt in for one of the best pars of my life, and very proudly tipped my cap to the gallery. Even Ernie congratulated me. Ernie parred the hole and held on to win by three, but that sand shot, which ranks as one of the best I've ever played in my life, made my day and eased the pain of losing. The no-fail setup. More than any other shot in golf, the setup for the standard bunker shot determines the type of swing I make and the way the club behaves when it enters.